I'm not talking about a topic that is as controversial as some of the other ones here. It's actually a very easy claim to make. And the claim is that the Fed was and remains to be a willing financier of wars committed by the U.S. government. And really, this applies to central banks around the world. But I'll be focusing on one particular event in the history of the Federal Reserve. It's called the Treasury-Fed Accord of 1951. But to set the tone here, I'd like to start off with a quote from Ron Paul, one of my favorites. He said, "It is no coincidence that the century of total war coincided with the century of central banking." And the idea here is that wars, especially world wars, total war, it's very expensive to run those sorts of things. And if the state had to collect taxes to finance these wars, the wars would be very unpopular. And of course, the state doesn't want the wars that it's involved in to be unpopular. And so they have to find other means to finance the war expenditure. They can't use taxes because they're unpopular. They can't use, you know, just direct plain borrowing because that causes all sorts of problems with interest rates. And so obviously what they've resorted to in World War I, World War II, and in war since then is money printing. And the reason money printing is so nice for the government is because its effects are delayed, it's more complicated. What we've seen throughout Federal Reserve history is that it's harder for the citizenry to pinpoint who's actually to blame for the inflation. And so that's exactly why the century of central banking coincided with the century of total war. The Treasury-Fed Accord occurred in 1951, and the myth says that this established the Fed's independence, that there was now finally a wall of separation or a fence between the Treasury and the Fed. But what I'll claim, and it's a very easy claim, as I'll show, is that what it actually established is just further a continuation of cooperation between the Treasury and the Fed, even though there was a change in rhetoric. Like if you look at some of the public statements, speeches by Fed officials, even congressmen today, they'll talk about Federal Reserve independence. But it's very clear that what's actually going on is that there's just, you know, a very tight fit. They cooperate with one another. They coordinate with one another. So here's the myth. This is taken directly from federalreservehistory.org, a website run by the Federal Reserve. An author named Romero said, "Independence and insulation from political pressures are essential to the ability of a nation's central bank to conduct monetary policy. During World War II and its aftermath, the Federal Reserve did not enjoy such independence. In 1951, however, the Treasury Department and the Fed reached an agreement now known as the Treasury-Federal Reserve Accord. This accord affected the liberation of monetary policy and laid the foundation for the modern Federal Reserve." And so this is sort of like a landmark event in all histories of the Federal Reserve. The idea, the implication that you get is that the Treasury was twisting the Fed's arm, that the Fed was, you know, sick and tired of financing the wars of the state and all of the other government expenditures that were going on. And the Fed really wanted to do its own thing. They were tired of seeing all of this price inflation. And the idea was that the Fed just wanted to break free of what the Treasury wanted to do. But after World War II, there were interest rate pegs established, and the Fed was effectively forced to maintain these low interest rates for government debt. Romero says that the Fed had to keep buying securities, even if the members of the Federal Open Market Committee might have preferred a different monetary policy. However, I don't really see much arm twisting. It seems like the Fed was happy to do this during World War I and in World War II. And in fact, if you look at, you know, Federal Reserve statements from officials, from the chair even, from the Board of Governors annual report, you see that they were happy to do this, that this was their primary objective. So for example, in World War II, the Federal Reserve System was prepared to use its powers to assure at all times an ample supply of funds for financing the World War II effort. Then the World War II ends and the Korean War starts and the U.S. enters the Korean War. And both the Treasury and the Fed were worried about another world war. They were concerned about World War III. And what they were considering is all of the expenditures that would be required to finance such an effort. So the Korean War by itself was going to be expensive. And so the Fed started, or at least one or two people at the Fed started, you know, flexing their powers. They, you know, started allowing some interest rates to change just a tiny little bit, trying to establish a little bit of independence. And so this sort of ignited this public battle between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. But as I'll show, it was mainly one, maybe two people at the Fed, at least that much, but definitely not a majority, definitely not you know, consensus among the Fed that they were tired of doing this sort of thing. In 50, 51, the Treasury and the Fed, they issued these public statements. There was this public battle. Truman was, you know, leaking stuff to the press, trying to discredit the Fed chair. And of course, they had their, at least publicly, they had these different opinions. And so the reason I put the asterisk there next to the Fed saying they issued statements is that it seems like it was mainly Thomas McKay, the Fed chair since 1948. Truman had actually fired Mariner Eccles. And so Eccles was on the side of Fed independence, but it seems to me like a lot of the reason for him doing that is he had this personal animosity against Truman for being fired. As the story goes, the Fed was unsatisfied with the price inflation at the time. It reached a 21% in February of 1951. To sort of see the pro-independence side as espoused by Eccles, there was this exchange between a congressman by the name of Patman with Eccles. And throughout this exchange, you see the Patman is saying, the Fed really ought to do the right thing and go along with whatever the Treasury wants. He said, who is master, the Federal Reserve or the Treasury? You know, the Treasury came here first. Eccles responded, how do you reconcile the Treasury's position of saying that they want the interest rate low with the Federal Reserve standing ready to peg the market and at the same time expect to stop inflation? Patman says, you're sabotaging the Treasury. I think it ought to be stopped. And Eccles responds, either the Federal Reserve should be recognized as having some independent status, or it should be considered as simply an agency or a bureau of the Treasury. I mentioned at the beginning of this, at the title for this slide, that it was Eccles, Sproul, and McCabe on one side, and Truman, Snyder, and Vardaman on the other. Vardaman was actually on the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve. Truman obviously was president. Snyder was the Treasury Secretary. So on that side, you have the people who want the Treasury to dominate the Federal Reserve, that the Federal Reserve should just be subservient to whatever the Treasury wants. And Eccles, Sproul slightly, a lot of what Sproul's public statements were just, he wanted people to talk nicely to each other. He wanted the Treasury and the Fed to cooperate with one another, but not necessarily the Fed having this specific independent role and authority. McCabe, to me, seems to be the only one who was, you know, truly interested in Fed independence for the sake of Fed independence. And as I mentioned, Eccles, he just, while he, as you can see in these quotes, he was in favor of Fed independence, he was definitely sort of biased by this animosity towards Truman because Truman had fired him. Eccles, by the way, remained on the Board of Governors. As I said, there was no clear consensus in the Federal Reserve. So a lot of the more brief histories of the Federal Reserve, they'll say the Federal Reserve wanted independence. But if you look closely at their minutes, if you look at the discussions that they had, it was clear that there was no consensus, maybe not even a majority opinion about this. It might have been a small minority, maybe just McCabe, who was making these statements. For example, Vardaman had written a statement asserting that McCabe had given Truman every reason to believe that the committee and the board would support the government financing program. McCabe accused Vardaman of leaking an account of the FOMC executive session. Evans said he wanted the minutes to show that he did not believe Vardaman's statement, so there was definitely some infighting here. Several senators had informed McCabe that a board member was undermining with members of Congress the FOMC's position. McCabe threatened to dismiss anybody who was making these leaks. Very importantly, at least from Truman's statement, he said that it was his understanding that a majority of the Reserve Board members sided with him. So I'm not sure if that's an exaggeration, maybe an outright lie, but it seems like he wouldn't have said that unless there were some people at the Federal Reserve who were happy to play along, play nicely with the Treasury. Okay, so then we reached the accord. McCabe had issued the statement, we're done with this. We're not going to play along with the Treasury anymore. We want to be independent. And then in early March, Snyder, the Treasury Secretary, was in the hospital for cataract surgery. And so the Assistant Secretary, William McChesney Martin, was there at the accord. This was not a law that was passed. It was just a private meeting between the Treasury and some Federal Reserve officials. But representing the Treasury was Martin. And then the Fed was represented not by Eccles, not by Sproul, and not by McCabe either. It was represented by Robert Rouse, Woodleaf Thomas, and Winfield Riefler. personal accounts from Herzl and Leach. Leach had been a part of all of these discussions at the time, and so he had a lot of inside information about what Federal Reserve officials were saying about the accord and the events leading up to it. He said that Riefler's plan was the one that was adopted at the accord. And so I found some other writings by Riefler where he was clearly okay with the Federal Reserve being the Treasury's money printer, especially in times of war. So he said, it is not difficult to select the American economic decision that played the determining part in the outcome of the war. Clearly, it was the decision to go all out for war production after Pearl Harbor. So he's okay with, or at least sees that this is what allowed the United States to win the war or help win the war. Another player there, Robert Rouse, he was the one who successfully reacquired the Fed's authority to do repurchase agreements, which is the primary tool that the Fed used during World War I to finance that war's financing. So he's the one who reacquired this special authority of the Fed to do the very thing that he's supposedly not representing here in this meeting. He's supposed to be representing the Fed's interests for independence. So they both the Treasury and the Fed released statements after the fact, although what exactly happened in the meeting isn't perfectly clear. And there's some conflicting statements, actually. And there was a senator by the name of Paul Douglas who tried to get to the bottom of it, but he was unsuccessful in doing so, questioning Treasury officials and Fed officials after the fact. As I said, the details are hazy. The Fed agreed to certain temporary rate pegs, and the Treasury agreed to replace their 2.5% marketable bonds for slightly higher non-marketable bonds. And this meant that the Fed wouldn't have to buy them. But other accounts explained that the Fed promised to raise its discount rate only with the Treasury's permission, which was unlikely to be given except under very compelling circumstances. So it seems like either they both made these sorts of compromises, or it seems like the Fed is still under the thumb of the Treasury, even based on what was said inside this accord. However, a lot of the evidence about what happened with the accord occurred after the fact. And so that's what the remainder and maybe the bulk of this talk will show. In the aftermath, just a few weeks later, like 2 or 3 weeks after this meeting, McCabe, the Fed chair, resigned. He sent in a bitter letter of resignation, but then resubmitted a bland one when asked to do so by the White House. So he was McCabe, the one who was very much in favor of Fed independence. He didn't like what happened at the accord and then resigned and was angry about it and only submitted a bland version of his resignation letter when he was pressured to do so by the White House. Leach, the one who was talking with a lot of these Fed officials at the time, he said the initial reaction both among board staff and on Wall Street to Martin's appointment, so William McChesney Martin, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, was then appointed by Truman to be the Fed chair. The Treasury guy became the chair of the Federal Reserve just a few weeks after this accord. So the reaction to this was that the Fed had won the battle but lost the war. That is, the Fed had broken free from the Treasury, but then the Treasury had recaptured it by installing its own man. Okay, so in a lot of these accounts, like I said, this is not a controversial claim. There are even some mainstream economists who say that the Fed is not truly independent, or they're independent in some limited way, but not in others. But I haven't seen anybody go through what Martin said in this interview. And there's a lot of very revealing statements about what this new Fed chair, who was previously at the Treasury, thought about the relationship between the Treasury and the government and the Federal Reserve. And so one question was, do you have any obligation to help them finance the deficit? We do, he says. How do you derive that duty? Well, because we are part of the government. He was asked questions about a huge increase in debt that might occur if the if another world war were sparked, or if there are huge expenditures associated with some other war. And Martin responded, "In war, ordinary rules go out the window. You just have to adjust as best you can. I think you have to use every weapon in a war." He was asked, "When you speak of we, do you mean the Federal Reserve Board or the government as a whole?" He says, "It applies to the government as a whole, but I'm speaking particularly about the Federal Reserve section of it. We have a responsibility for seeing that money and credit is coordinated with the other government activities." And so this term coordination and cooperation, them working together, this shows up a lot in not just Martin's testimony, but in a lot of the public statements after the accord, is that, the Fed is independent, but in the same breath, the same sentence, they'll say, but the Treasury and the Fed are coordinated. They cooperate with one another. And it seems like there's a conflict there in terms of, I don't know, it's like an oxymoron. It doesn't make sense to say that they're independent, but working together. In fact, the number of times that you see coordination and cooperation in their statements, it actually gives you this impression that like they had met to establish the story, like criminals who are agreeing on a story before they go talk to the police. Like that's how many times they bring up this term coordination and cooperation. Later in the interview, he said, "We can never omit the needs of the Treasury from our considerations." At that time, the new Treasury team that had come in, and we had worked very closely with them, as with their predecessors, and they had given us excellent cooperation, there it is again, faced a heavy financing task and had to borrow far more than they had expected because the government deficit was going to be substantially greater than had been thought. In another question, this one more about like how the Federal Reserve was able to help finance the war effort. The question was, "But the dollar's been cut more than in half in the past 10 to 15 years, and they've accepted it," talking about American citizens. Martin's answer, "They accepted it only through the exigency of war, and I don't think they accepted it." Question, "Didn't this come after the war?" Martin said, "Oh no, not the monetary inflation that was almost entirely a part of the war." So here he seems still in step with what the Federal Reserve was saying before the accord, which is that we use monetary inflation during war to help finance government expenditure, to help the government expropriate resources from the private economy. Here's Martin mentioning Douglas, and there was this committee hearing where Douglas was questioning the Treasury and Fed officials. Martin says, "Douglas stated a number of times that we should have a mandate specifying clearly what is the role of debt management and what is the role of money and credit policy. He said, good fences make good neighbors. I agree that good fences make good neighbors, but the nature of this problem is such that you need a revolving door in the fence so that both of us can go through it, because adjustments have to be made from time to time." And so like, it's clear that this is in 1955, so 4 years after the accord. And by the way, Martin is held up in these official narratives as like the guy who helped the Fed flex its muscles and become independent and establish what we now know as the modern Fed. But it seems very clear to me, based on these statements, that he's squarely in the category of okay with Fed cooperation with the Treasury. Speaking of the revolving door, it's a regular thing for the Fed chair to meet with the Treasury even today. I don't know if it's like a weekly basis, but very frequently the Fed chair and the Treasury secretary, they meet together even today, and they talk about this. But in terms of like a more literal revolving door between the Fed and the Treasury, we see that through the past five Fed chairs, where they either before or after had positions very close to the president, especially as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, or were a part of the Treasury. So Jay Powell, the current chair, he was assistant secretary and undersecretary of the Treasury, and now he's the Fed chair. Before Yellen was Fed chair, she was the chair of the CEA, and after she became secretary of the Treasury. For Bernanke, before he became Fed chair, he was the chair of CEA under George W. Bush. Greenspan was also the chair of the CEA. Volcker was also in the Treasury in high positions. He was the director of the Treasury's Office of Financial Analysis and a deputy undersecretary for monetary affairs. So there is quite literally a revolving door in terms of, you know, Fed chairs and treasury officials, you know, swapping out jobs, and also the Council of Economic Advisors. More on the Council of Economic Advisors as sort of a this group that meets with the president, selected by the president. In 1962, Walter Heller was the chair of the CEA. Not a good guy, by the way. He said that this was a letter addressed to William McChesney Martin at the Fed. He said, at the opening meeting of the IMF consultation in March, both Secretary Dillon and you referred to the fine cooperation that there had been all last year among the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and the Council. I agree with that appraisal. So it seems like both the Fed and the Treasury are agreeing that they're working together nicely. This goes up to the president. So JFK reappointed Martin to be Fed chair, and he said that he has cooperated effectively in the economic policies of this administration. This is the opposite of independence, by the way. It's supposed to be a break between what the president is doing and wants in his administration and what the Federal Reserve is doing. And I look forward to a constructive working relationship in the years ahead. As you know, the Federal Reserve System is a fully independent agency of the U.S. government. Same breath, but it is essential that there exist a relationship of mutual confidence and cooperation between the Fed, the economic agencies of the administration, including especially the Secretary of the Treasury and the President. He has my full confidence, he says. It was more than just these public statements, however. Kennedy had strongly urged Congress to increase the pay of Federal Reserve officials and the chair of the Federal Reserve to match the pay of cabinet members. And he wanted to effectively make the Fed chair a cabinet position, basically. He has asked Congress, speaking of Kennedy, he has asked Congress to raise the salary level of the seven-man board, and he wants to make the term of the chairman coincide with the presidency so that the chief executive could choose his own man for the post. Later, he must be responsible to the president. And who agreed to this, who endorsed this plan? William McChesney Martin. William McChesney Martin, the president, the present chairman, endorses the president's recommendations. So this man who's held up to be the champion of Fed independence is A-OK with the Fed chair becoming effectively a cabinet member for the president. If you look closely at what monetary policy looked like in the decades following the accord, it's clear that no independence was established. And so George Selgin said that Martin proved a pushover when it came to resisting government influence. And he claims, and it's a very easy claim to make, that the reason why there was a low inflation shortly after is because Eisenhower was an inflation hawk. So although that seems like, if you just sort of look at the price inflation data, monetary inflation data, it seems like, there was a change in Fed policy. But if you're explaining the change in Fed policy because there was a change in the president and the president's views, it just means that's further evidence that there is cooperation, there is connection between what the president wants, what the Treasury wants, and what the Fed is doing. In a statistical analysis of changes in Federal Reserve monetary policy, an author by the name of Weintraub said, it may be reasonably urged that the dominant guiding force behind monetary policy is the president. That was the best statistical explainer of what the Federal Reserve was doing from 51 to 77, was who was president at the time and what were their economic and financial objectives and plans. If you look at a time series of government spending, the total amount of public debt, and what the Treasury needs to do to finance the government, and you compare it to Federal Reserve actions, especially how much of the government's debt it's purchasing, you see there's a tight fit. So here, this is from the early 70s to 2000. The blue line is federal debt held by Federal Reserve banks. So how much of the public debt is being bought by the Federal Reserve? And the red line is total public debt. And as you see, there's this nice relationship. The more that the government needs to borrow, as the needs of the Treasury are expanding in terms of how much debt they need to issue, the Federal Reserve is there to sop it up in proportion, right? So it's not a one-to-one because the Fed does not buy all of the government's debt, but you do see there is a nice connection here. Of course, this has a lot of bearing on what's going on today, or at least the Fed independence is coming up a lot today, mainly because of Trump's statements about he wants to fire Jay Powell. He thinks he's a fool. The Fed must lower the rate, so he's even trying to give recommendations on Federal Reserve interest rate policy. One of my favorites, my only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi? So there's like this, it seems like there's this fighting between the president and the Fed chair. But if you look at other statements, like from Jay Powell, he says this often. He says, we take what they, Congress, the government, do as a given, and we put it in our models and in our assessment of the economy. So what the Fed is doing is that it's just sort of taking as a given what the government is doing and then making a plan. There's not you know, pure independence. They're actually taking in how much debt the government needs to sell in as an input into their deliberation on how much money to print. Scott Bessent, the new Treasury Secretary, said, "I'm sure Powell is going to do the right thing." So this is coming up a lot, and even if you look at more recent time series, so red is total federal outlays and blue is the total assets of the Federal Reserve System. Of course, since 2008, the Federal Reserve has taken on purchasing all sorts of different things, not just government debt. But like one of the starkest examples of Federal Reserve dependence, or the Federal Reserve doing exactly what the Treasury needs them to do, is when there was a huge increase in government spending in 2020. There was also a huge increase, like a similar increase in money printing. So the Fed remains committed to this. They're ready to do this sort of thing. I have about one minute to comment on this question as to whether independence is a good thing or a bad thing. But I think I'll leave that for Joe Salerno to talk about. And you can check out this podcast and other speeches that Salerno's talked about. But it's definitely not clear that independence is necessarily a good thing. It seems like independence allows them to play the scapegoat sort of game, where the Treasury and the president can blame the Fed for bad things happening, and the Fed can blame the Treasury and the government for racking up a large amount of debt. And in fact, Powell says very often public debt is on an unsustainable path. But I'll just conclude by saying that the Fed is and always has been ready to finance war or other government spending with money printing, and there's no true Fed independence, especially not as established by the Treasury Fed Accord. Thank you.